Happy Sabbath, everyone. I am very happy to see all of you here this bright and early Sabbath morning. I was not here last weekend. I did stalk you from afar, though, so I know what happened. But I'm very happy to see you guys all here. Please bow your heads with me as we go into our sermon time. Dear God, thank you so much for this day. Thank you so much for just the space that we can come to and be for a little bit. Calm all the chaos that's in our lives and put those all outside the doors for at least a little bit so that way we can be here in peace together as a community. Thank you for being a loving God. We love you in your name. Amen. When I was little, as most of you guys know, I always start this way, I grew up in a different place. And as a child that grew up in Africa, obviously I didn't have the same toys as the average child, right? Like I remember getting in the mail some weird stuff. Like I got those Cabbage Patch Kids dolls in the mail. Some of you are the same age as me and remember these. They'd freak me out and I would just stare at them from a distance. But really, the only thing that occupied 90% of my time was this little sport called football. You guys know what that is? In the U.S., yeah, soccer, right? So you don't need much, right? You just need neighborhood children or adults and any place, really. The woods works or in a yard or in a field and a ball. And so for most of my, like, 5 or 6 years as a child in that space of time, all I did in my spare time was play soccer. Now, I went to a French school, but then when I finally transferred to the missionary school, I was the only girl really there. And so there became this weird thing because I played soccer, but also I wasn't like speed racer or super skilled or anything, and I was, so I'm teeny tiny and not able to compete like the other guys. And so I learned rather rapidly that I had to take up whatever position was available. So that's what I would do. So I would play wing or I'd play defense, depending on who was already on the field. And every so often, my nightmare would come true, and I would have to play goal. Now, remember, I'm like 6 years old, right? Playing goal against kids that are in eighth grade or ninth grade is terrifying. Meet my teacher, who is also just a terrifying human being because he's more hyperactive than all of us combined. And he's like Mr. Gusto when it comes to soccer, like full, like his leg goes all the way back. And then like as he kicks, it's like just a cannonball flying at your face, right? And he had no pity on me. Like you'd think he was like, oh, this little cute girl, like she's just little in the goal. Nope. I remember this one specific time I saw him. He was tripping over everyone and he was like jumping over to the other kids and he had the ball and he's dribbling down. And I see him coming at me and I'm sitting there and I'm just like getting like further and further back into the goal. And finally I have this man up moment, right? And I step forward and I'm like, yeah. And he kicks the ball and no joke, it hits me square in the face. And it flips my body up in the air. And my brother says that I just laid on the ground. I woke up a little bit later, and my teacher is standing over me in just like a panic, right? So these are my memories of my childhood, right? Good times. And the thing is I still loved soccer. So I went to, you know, when we moved to Russia, we would play soccer in the woods on the ice, right? Practical, but we would do it. And then when I got to high school, I wanted to play, but there was no girls' team, and so, yeah. I just joined the guys' team and played with whatever position they would let me play. And eventually, what's up, Tyler? Eventually, they let me go ahead and create a girls' team with some of the other girls. And then I got to college, and I found out this little thing called a scholarship for sports. So I played soccer in college. And I remember being really excited about this because I was like, oh, this is great. Like, I can get all of my, like, I don't know, like, violence out of me, maybe? I don't know. Because when you're playing soccer in like college, you're allowed to be aggressive and just go for it, right? And I remember I was like so stoked because they give you a position also. You're not like the freelance soccer player that everyone else makes you be. So I was so excited because I was going to be able to be this like one space soccer player. The only problem is that I had played so many different positions that I became, yeah, I played wing, but then I was everyone else's backup. And I remember we were in championship games my senior year, and we were playing against this team that was destroying us. And we were tied, but they were like emotionally destroying us. And I remember our goalie got knocked out like 10 minutes before the game was gonna end. And my coach calls me to the side, and I'm like, "Coach, can I just nap on the bench? Like, just put anyone in. I'm just going to need a nap real quick." And he's like, "Nope, you're going in goal." And I was like, "I'm sorry, what?" And like all the PTSD of like actually talented soccer players like kicking balls at my face, I was like, no, I'm not going in goal. Like, nope, this is not happening. He's like, "You're the only one that knows how, so you have to go." And I freaked out and panicked for like a solid 30 seconds until suddenly my team started rallying around me and they're like, "No, you're going to do it. You're going to do great." And the goalie who had like this big welt on her head from like the pole was like, "You'll be fine. It's good. You're going to be great." And finally, like, I'm like trembling and I walk over to the goal and I'm standing there and we're playing the last couple of minutes of the game and we're still tied. And I'm like, "Oh, this is getting so intense. They shoot at me." And you know, if you play goal, you just kind of have to commit to wherever you're going to dive. Right? So like I'm like committing to these dives and I'm freaking out and I have so much anxiety and I just can't do it. And I keep looking at my teammates and they're all cheering and they're like, we got this, except for we tied and we had to go into the sudden death shootout. Guys, the sudden death shootout. And I'm like, I can't breathe. I'm freaking out. I'm having this emotional meltdown in the goal. And I look over and my teammates, they don't look scared and it's upsetting me. Because they're all like, "You can do it." And they're lining up to kick on their side. And I see the other people lining up to kick on my side. And I'm panicking. And then my coach yells out. And he was like, "We really have nothing to lose." Except for one of the championship games, right? The sudden death shootout happens. And somehow, we won. This fear, this anxiety, this everything that was coming over me, I did not know how to handle it or process it. But all of the words yelled from the sideline, all the people that somehow believed in me and believed that I could do this, it was overwhelming and inspiring. And because of that, I was able to then go ahead and take the challenge and go ahead and just play goalie and commit to it. There's a story that I've always loved, but it's also always weirded me out. It's a story in Judges. It's found, if you guys have Bibles or phones, Judges 6 through 8. It's a story about Gideon. You guys know the story of Gideon? No, great, I will tell you. So there's a story of Gideon, and it's really great. It's sad time. It's been peace for 40 years, and then now the Midianites, these like roaming free crazy people, have come into the Israelites' territory, and they are quoted to be like locusts. They have brought all their flocks. They have destroyed all of their crops. They have robbed them of literally everything around them. They don't know how to like even begin to rebuild their communities. And these locusts are just seeping in and eating away their lives. So this is where you find the Israelites. They have turned to Baal. They have turned to Asherah. And they are once again relapsed back into worshiping other gods in general. So here you find Gideon. And we're going to start chapter 6, verse 11. It says, "The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah and belonged to Joash the Abizurite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, 'The Lord is with you, mighty warrior.'" Now, I would like to pause right here, and I find this funny because where is Gideon? He is threshing wheat in a wine press. This is code for he's hiding from people because he's too scared to thresh his wheat out in public because he needs the wind to be able to get like the flax stuff off the top. But instead, he's too scared, and so he goes and hides in a wine press. And then the angel says to him, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." Right? Weird start. "But sir," Gideon replied, "if the Lord is with us, why has all of this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, 'Did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian." The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? But the Lord," Gideon asked, "how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." So this is where it starts. He's hiding out. He's threshing his wheat. He's trying to like hide from the Midianites. He's so terrified. Then this guy comes up to him and he's like, "You're a mighty warrior." And he's like, "Yeah, right. No, I'm not. Weren't you supposed to come and save us?" And then he's like, "No, I am sending you." And then again, Gideon replies, "But I'm the weakest in my clan and the least in my family. I am the least." The angel goes on, and if you guys know anything about the story, the angel says, "No, I've chosen you. You're going to go. You're going to save Israel." And Gideon says, I have one more thing. Can you just hang on here for a second? I need a sign. So he runs and he prepares all this food. He comes back. He sets it before the angel of the Lord. And he says, okay, here's a sign, right? The angel of the Lord picks up his staff and he touches it and it goes into flames. Now, if you guys remember, we talked a couple weeks ago about Elijah and flames and sacrifices and all that stuff, right? So this is a throwback to Elijah, if you want to think about it that way. And also Moses with the staff. And then Gideon's so overwhelmed, he's like, you are the angel of the Lord. And he pulls back and he builds this altar to God. And it's the first time in a long time that they've been able to worship God on their own altar because they've been using Baal and Asherah. And then the angel of the Lord challenges him and he says, go, you need to go and you need to tear down your father's altars. And Gideon's like, all right, I'm your man, right? He's like pumped up, except he does it in the middle of the night. He goes and he gets a bull and he pulls down the little altar and he like cuts the Asherah pole. And then he's like, yeah, I did it. Right? But he's secretive. He's sneaky. He doesn't man up in this moment and go and do it in the daylight and show that God is on my side, because God has just proven to him at this moment, right, that he can do it. And instead, he sneaks around at night. The next morning, the entire community wakes up and everyone's in a roar. Like, what is happening? Like, didn't you say that, like, your son was on the side of us and all this stuff? And his father begins to get picked on. And they're like, we need to get your son in trouble. Like, we should kill him because he's destroyed the altar to Baal. And I love what his dad says, actually. He says, are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down his altar. Right? Pretty cool. And so everyone kind of backs off a little bit and waits and sees, and nothing happens. Time goes on a little bit more, and Gideon is like still a little bit unsure, but he knows that he's supposed to be doing something. And so Gideon goes, okay, so God, one more thing. I know that you burned the old sacrifice thing and you were like all wizardly and stuff, but can you do me one more thing? I'm going to put this fleece out, and what I want you to do is, as if I wake up in the morning and the dew is dried off of the ground around it, then the fleece is holding all the water, and then I'm going to believe you and I'm going to do what you asked me to do. So he wakes up the next morning, but if you guys know anything about basic nature, right, the fleece is going to retain the water a little bit longer than the ground. So he wrings it out and he's like, oh man, nature, right? And he's like, okay, God, I know that you kind of answered that prayer, but I'm not actually sure if you did. And so what I need you to do is do the opposite. All right. So the fleece needs to be dry. The ground needs to be completely wet when I wake up in the morning. And so he goes to bed and he wakes up, and sure enough, the fleece is dry. Now, I think at this point, I'd probably be like, got it. Weird, but let's do this, right? Except for probably, I don't know, I'd probably come up with like maybe 10 more things I need to prove before I start, you know, a battle with one of the nation's greatest enemies. But Gideon follows through. And he says, you know, I'm ready, but I need to get an army together. And so he goes and he grabs his trumpet and he begins blowing this trumpet throughout the community, calling all the able men together. And he gets to this point where he has an actual semi-army going on. And he's feeling pretty good about it. The only problem is that God's like, yeah, no, that's too many men. You have too many. And so then he says, Gideon, here's what you need to do. You need to go tell all of these guys that if you're scared even a little bit, go ahead and go home. Right? And so Gideon's like, okay, sure. And so that's exactly what he does. Is he's like, okay, guys, if you're freaked out even a little bit, feel free to go home. And he loses a ton of his army. So many that he actually begins to panic a little bit. And then God says, you still have too many. And so now you need to take your remaining, like, quarter of the troops down to the river, and you need to have them drink out of the river. Those that stick their face down and lap up with their tongue, they can go home. And those that scoop up and drink like this, they can stay. How many men stayed? You guys know this one? Bible trivia. 300, right? Only 300 men did what God specified and asked. And so now Gideon's looking over his little teeny tiny army of 300 men. And he's wondering, how on earth am I going to be able to do this? But the Lord said, hey, I have your back still. In fact, I have it so much that I'm going to send you down into the camp tonight, and I'm going to hear my answer to your prayer. And so Gideon and his servant run down to the camp, and they're sneaking around, and they hear this guy talking about his dream. And one of the soldiers is talking, and he's saying, you know, I had this crazy dream. This loaf of barley came into our camp and destroyed everything and everyone, and we were defeated. And then someone said, that's Gideon. Okay, so that's a pretty clear sign, right, that Gideon's going to be fine, right? And so Gideon's like, oh, yeah, we totally got this. And so he suddenly has all this energy and ability to be able to tackle anything. And he goes back up. He rallies his 300 groups of men. And he's like, okay, you guys just follow my lead. Here's the trumpet. Here's this jar. In the jar, we're going to have these torches. And we're going to surround this area and just follow my lead. When the time comes, blow the trumpet and drop the pot. And so that's what they do. They surround the entire army of the Midianites, only 300 men. And at this one glorious moment, they all begin to blast their trumpets. And then they begin to throw down these jars and pots. And then these flames start coming up. And the enemy becomes disillusioned and crazy. Now, here's the thing that I think is so funny. In this moment, Gideon's like, okay, all you have to do is this, and we're going to have this amazing, glorious miracle, and we're going to win. It's going to be victorious, and it's going to be beautiful. And then he says to them, all you have to do is blow the trumpet and drop these jars. But he also had one more phrase, and I think it's so, so funny, because he basically yells out, he says to them, yell out, for the Lord and for Gideon. Right? It's like, for the Lord and for Gideon, right? And they're all standing there chanting and yelling this thing. And I'm like, how crazy is this dude that he obviously had to be proved like 30 times that he's capable of doing this thing. And then he has the guts to be like, and Gideon, that's right, me. I'm the one that did this. It's all me. And so that's what they do. The army goes into chaos and they begin to flee. And Gideon chases after them, constantly yelling for the Lord and for Gideon. And he defeats their enemies. Now, this is a great story because Gideon obviously was an insecure, slightly scared, non-confrontational, non-warrior-like person. However, God had seen something in him and had been decidedly able to call him and say, you know what, you have something bigger than this going on. You have something that you need to follow through with, and I'm going to give you the strength through it, even though you're going to ask me incessant questions to prove that you can do it. And even then, Gideon kind of messes it up near the end, right? For God and for Gideon. He forgets where it all came from. Now, the thing that I find so interesting about this is that this is such a human nature moment. This is something that all of us face. This is the challenge that almost all of us go into, is when things get bigger than us, when things get more complicated than us, when our job shift or our schooling changes, or we go through a breakup, or when we meet people that maybe push us out of our comfort zone, or maybe transitions happen and people don't know exactly where they fit anymore, we get scared. And we start demanding results. We start demanding these things, and we're trying to get God to answer us. And sometimes we feel like we're incredibly alone, and we get overwhelmed by these moments. And I think Gideon was in that spot. For 7 years, he felt abandoned because God was not there to take them out of the famine, out of the oppression of the Midianites. And then someone shows up and says it's his job to do it, and he doesn't know how to process that. But then all of the resources and all of the things started being handed to him, and he's slowly being built up. And he's slowly being able to face all of those challenges and those things that have scared him for so long. And he goes in there confident, sometimes a little overconfident, and he saves Israel. And he becomes one of the judges. This made me think about a story that I think I've used, it's pretty much one of my favorite stories on the planet, so you probably have heard me talk about it. It's a story about this little boy and his parents who were at the beach, and they were just walking along the beach, and it's a Rob Bell story he talks about with his family, and they're walking along the beach, and little kids doing what little kids do, right, and they're picking up all the fun shells, they're picking up the rocks, they're picking up all these different things, and pretty soon their hands are overflowing with treasures from the ocean, right? And as they go down the beach a little bit further, suddenly the little boy, he looks up at his dad and he's like, Dad, did you see that? And he points over and there's this big starfish bobbing near the shore. And the dad's like, oh, cool. And he's like, go ahead, you can go get it. It's not that deep. And so the little boy runs out and he gets up to about his ankles and he stops and he turns around and he runs back to his dad and his dad's like, what's wrong? Go ahead and go get it. And the little boy's like, yeah, okay, okay. So he runs out, and he gets a little bit deeper. He gets about his knees, and he stops, and he turns around. And he runs to his dad and he's like, "Dad, it's just, you know." And his dad's like, "It's really not that deep, son. Go ahead and go get it." And finally, the little boy runs in a little bit deeper. He gets about to his waist and he's right standing looking at the starfish, the thing that he wants the most. And he turns around and he has these tears in his eyes and he runs back to his dad and mom. And he's like, "I want it, but I can't get it." And they're like, "It's right there. What happened?" And he's like, "I can't grab it." And they're like, "Why not?" And he said, "Because I have all these shells in my hands." And this is us. We're handed all these tools. We have all these things that we pick up along the way. Some of them are really good. Some of them are not so good. And sometimes we think that we have all this stuff going for us, all these treasures, all these beautiful things. But we get to the point where we see the ultimate thing that we want or the thing that we need. And we have all this stuff in our hands. And it distracts us from our ultimate goal, from our ultimate experience, from our ultimate blessing. Because we've gotten so distracted by the broken shells, by the shiny rocks, by all the things that life throws at us, and we miss out on the opportunity of the ultimate goal. And so what I want to encourage you guys with today is to take a look at what are the things that are in your hands. We're all handed success stories. We're all handed something that can succeed, that can grow us, that can push us to the end, that can make us be able to be the thing that God has planned for us or our community needs or whatever it may be. And sometimes we have so many other little things that are distracting us that we're not able to reach that thing. And so I want to encourage you guys that here's a space, here's a community where you can start using the resources that you've been handed instead of just holding on to them for no reason. If you have a goal, if you have something that you see or need or want to be part of, or if you're going through something that maybe is distracting you from the ultimate peace that you actually want, I want to ask you to look at what's in your hands. It's not all bad. Some of those shells and shiny rocks are going to be the things that get you through. But there's also other stuff in there that maybe doesn't need to be in there anymore. And maybe you need to be like Gideon and say, "Okay, I'm going for it. It makes no sense, but God is on my side and we're going to do this." And we're going to step out in faith and we're going to challenge ourselves to a new life, a new way, and not get so caught up in our own little whirlwind of chaos that we miss out on the ultimate prize, on the experience, on the community that is beautiful and healing, on the relationships that are growing, on all the different things that are out there that we've just been missing out on for so long because we have not prioritized the things that we care about the most. I want to encourage you guys as a community to start dreaming big, to start looking for that ultimate prize, the ultimate goal, the ultimate thing that's going to create healing on this earth. And let's take back that land from the Midianites, and let's live well and love each other. Amen.